Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frog.
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. I'm Peter B. Collins with Sibel Edmonds. And our guest on this program is Philip Giraldi, a former officer in the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. He writes extensively on the web. He has published at American Conservative Magazine and also at the website antiwar.com. And according to Wikipedia, he's presently a partner in an international security consulting firm, Canestraro Associates. Philip Giraldi, welcome to our program.
Well, good evening.
Nice to talk with you. And during this hour, we want to discuss with you issues related to a powerful and influential lobby group called the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. And they have, as we mentioned, strong influence and on both sides of the political aisle in Washington, D.C. And this is an area that's very sensitive. There are many media outlets that really don't touch on anything critical of AIPAC. And it is a reflection, I think, of their deep influence with our political leadership in Washington. And during this program, we want to talk about some of the recent issues that have surfaced relating to two employees of AIPAC, Steve Rosen and Keith Weissman, and also an American named Larry Franklin. And we'll explain the connections and some of the things that have occurred. First, Phil Giraldi, could you give us a quick sketch of AIPAC beyond what I just offered?
Well, AIPAC is basically a pro-Israeli lobby. And what is particularly interesting about AIPAC, apart from the fact that it's extremely powerful and has tremendous influence both over the White House and Congress and the media, is the fact that, in spite of the fact that it represents a foreign government, it has never been required by law to register as a lobbying agency of a foreign government, which other lobbies are required to do.
And is there any explanation for that?
Well, it's basically a reflection of the fact that the lobby is so powerful and has been able to avoid that bullet. If you go back to the Kennedy administration, John F. Kennedy was pushing to have the predecessor of AIPAC declared as a lobby of a foreign government. But when he was killed, that effort stopped. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson and presidents that succeeded Johnson were not interested in taking up the issue. So AIPAC, in a sense, occupies a very peculiar position in terms of what goes on in Washington. It's extremely powerful, and it virtually has no restraint in terms of what it does and where its money comes from.
I'm sorry.
I know another organization that fits this description, and that is the American Turkish Council, the Turkish Lobby Group, and they are not registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act either, Phil.
I didn't know that. I know, as you know, quite a bit about that lobby, about that group. But the fact is that they modeled themselves on AIPAC. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. In fact, in 1994. Richard Pearl and Douglas Feith, they were registered agents for the government of Turkey, and they were registered under FARA. They shut down their own company, and they helped, together with JINSA, they helped the Turkish group set up the American Turkish Council.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And, of course, this points out the fundamental problem, which is you have groups that are representing foreign governments and are doing so in kind of a clandestine way. and they're not required to register, that which means when they don't register, of course, you don't know where their money comes from. That's a fundamental issue, and you don't know where the money is going.
And Phil, to the extent you can tell us from your own research, what are the connections between AIPAC and the government of Israel?
Well, the relationship is very close and continuing. AIPAC basically sees itself as the lobby, the principal lobby, for promoting Israeli interests. So the relationship is extremely close. AIPAC has a conference every year in Washington, and many American politicians, including at times U.S. presidents, have gone there to speak. And also there are senior officials from the Israeli government present also speaking and also making contacts with American political figures. So the relationship is a very intimate one.
Mm-hmm. And is it connected to a particular political wing in Israel? Would you say that it's linked to the Zionist elements, or is it broader than that?
Well, it's certainly linked to the Zionist element, because that's the philosophy or the fundamental philosophy of Israel. But it tends to be, at least in the last 10 years or so, be much more closely linked to the right-wing Israeli groups, the Likud party, and the groups that are associated with the conservative philosophy. At one time, of course, when the Labor Party was dominant in Israel, AIPAC was supportive of that. But the drift has very clearly been to the right.
Now, Phil Giraldi, going back to 2005, you wrote an article for the conservative publication, The American Conservative, in which you warned that the U.S. was planning an attack on Iran. And I appreciate you coming forward. I was covering that at the time. And there were limited sources that I could go to. Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel, was monitoring those events, and there were some journalists who likewise were paying close attention to it. And as I recall, in the spring of 2005, there was legislation pending in Washington, and some progressives or liberals had inserted language into a bill which explicitly said that the money could not be used for the planning or execution of a military assault on Iran. And in the period when that measure was up for debate, I also recall that Nancy Pelosi and other leading Democrats went to the AIPAC conference in, I believe it was April of that year, and gave speeches that were not so surprising. But shortly after that, and maybe the timing is only coincidental, the language regarding a ban on an assault on Iran was removed from that bill. Can you explain that episode a little bit and talk about the potential influence of AIPAC in that move?
Well, you have to understand that AIPAC has influence in both the Democratic and Republican parties. There are many people in the Democratic Party that are basically supportive of a very aggressive policy towards Iran. And Pelosi is one of those. I mean, she's always kind of talked the talk as being someone who's in favor of peace and negotiations. But when it comes, when you look at her voting record and you look at the issues that she's promoted, she basically is very, very much in favor of an aggressive policy towards Iran. So Iran, and indeed I would point out that this kind of thing is back on the table again. There is another motion that's going through the Senate and the House at this very moment, which would advocate in effect a military blockade of petroleum imports into Iran, which really by international law would be an act of war.
And actually, that's a very good interesting you made about Democrats and Republicans. In fact, I read this study that said the ratio of the donations to the political campaigns of the candidates for candidates between Democrats and Republicans by AIPAC and the pro-Israeli groups is actually 60% Democrats and 40% Republicans.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, basically there has been some shift in terms of how parties fund themselves now because of the Internet. But the fact is that that Jewish donors who have a very strong feeling about Israel are, it would seem, a majority in the Democratic Party and a considerable group also in the Republican Party.
Now, Phil, let's turn to this interesting case involving Larry Franklin, an American who was working at the Pentagon, who is described as an expert on Iran, and he was convicted of spying for Israel. Is that correct?
Well, he basically confessed, and he said that he had been spying for Israel and was convicted. Yes, that's correct.
And I believe he received a 12-year sentence.
He received a 12-year sentence, which recently was suspended. So, in fact, he did no jail time.
And do we know the process by which that sentence was suspended?
I must admit it's a little confusing. He was suspended after the other two people who were being tried in the case, Rosen and Weissman, were basically let off because the prosecution decided that given the restrictions given by the judge, they could not make their case. So the case was dropped, and as a result, the judge also assumed that the case against Franklin should be mitigated, in effect, and that he shouldn't have to do jail time. There was some stuff in the media today, however, about Franklin in the Washington Times, about Franklin saying that during this entire time he had been an FBI informant, and he was very unhappy about the way he was treated. So, you know, this is the kind of story that has a whole lot of hooks to it, and I'm not really sure at the end of the day where we are. But the fact is that it seems clear that at least Rosen and Weissman, who were AIPAC employees at the time, were taking classified information that they knew to be classified and passing it on to the media and also to the Israeli embassy.
Phil, would you say we don't know much about it and it's so convoluted? And in addition to that is the fact that we don't have within the mainstream media real investigative journalists really looking into it and digging there.
Well, we have investigative journalists, but they're not interested in these kinds of issues. This is basically part of the effectiveness of AIPAC, in that it stifles any kind of negative inquiry into Israel. I mean, you might look at the case last week in New Jersey, where there was a case of you know, really broad scale corruption in New Jersey politics, and a whole lot of the people that were involved in it were rabbis. And the money was going back to Israel to support settlements, which, of course, is not U.S. policy. But the fact is that this story has kind of died. Stories that are critical of Israel die very quickly.
Correct. And another thing that usually gets to be attached to this, and they are very good at doing this, is right away playing the anti-Semitism card. And it was interesting because that was one of the first sentences that Rosen and Weissman, they both used during their press conference after the charges were dropped, that this was basically witch hunt by the FBI and it was anti-Semitic. And Franklin has been using it lately. And just recently with these rabbis' cases, I'm seeing that it's basically mushrooming all over the blogosphere and even within some alternative media sources. Of course, in Israel, the mainstream media is covering it as FBI being engaged in this witch hunt against the Jewish descent people or the rabbis.
Yeah, that's what happens every time. I mean, obviously, if you want to defuse one of these cases or make it go away, you imply that it's anti-Semitic or you say it's anti-Semitic, and this has been very effective. But also, interestingly, if you follow the case as it's being reported in Israel, in Haaretz, which is a more liberal Israeli publication, you'll
Correct.
Find that there's a lot of angst about this, that, you know, what have we become? What are we doing? Because it involved, among other things, the sale of organs, didn't it? And so it's, you know, one should not sell the Israelis out too quickly. There are a lot of people in Israel who see this and see the problems and see the horrible things that are going on and are protesting against it. But the problem is the U.S. media. Now, this is really where the issue is. The U.S. media is not willing to play that kind of role itself. And anything that is particularly critical of Israel in any way is going to get deep-sixed after, you know, there might be an initial report, and then it disappears. I might cite, for example, the recent case of Ben-Ami Kadish, the Israeli spy at Picatinny Arsenal in New Jersey. You know, he had spied for Israel and provided them with highly sensitive information. Basically, he was fined and his case was dismissed and the story disappeared. This happens every time when there's anything that has to do with Israel.
And if we look at the case that goes back almost 20 years now of Jonathan Pollard, he was clearly convicted of spying for Israel, yet he has hero status, and on a regular basis, Israelis make a demand for his release.
That's right. In fact, Bill Clinton came very close to releasing him. George Bush was under incredibly heavy pressure from the Israeli lobby to release him, but this is probably the only good thing that George Bush ever did. He resisted.
So, Phil Giraldi, as we look at this situation, we have this American, Larry Franklin. He's been convicted but not sentenced, or the sentence has now been suspended, of spying for Israel. It gets more complicated now with his claim of being an FBI informant. And then we have these two gentlemen, Steve Rosen and Keith Wiseman, who were working for AIPAC. And what were their roles with the organization?
Well, as I recall, one of them was Rosen, I think, had a very senior position. He was the one who was kind of at the policy level in AIPAC. Wiseman, as I recall, was somewhat junior to that, and he was, in a sense, I believe, one of their marketers who went out and made contacts and developed the contact. So he's more like a salesman. So that was their role. That was their roles. And of course, AIPAC, when the case got very hot, disavowed them, and which forced them to actually sue AIPAC to pay for their legal expenses.
Interesting.
So it's kind of a funny case. Rosen continues to be a very hardliner and is associated with hardline Israeli groups in the United States. But Weissman, to a certain extent, has recanted, and he has said that he regrets what he did and that a lot of what the Israeli lobby was doing was wrong.
And you noted in a recent post that both Wiseman and Rosen now hold senior posts in the Israeli government?
No, I don't think. I didn't say that. No, Rosen is working for some lobbying groups and some interest groups. Wiseman, I am not really sure what he is doing. But
okay, did I misread this? Then let me quote from you here. It says both Gilon and Arad were involved in the FBI investigation of AIPAC that led to the conviction of Franklin and the indictment of Wiseman and Rosen. And then you say both now hold senior positions in the Israeli government. So
okay.
Does that refer to Gilon and Arad?
Yeah, that refers to Gilon and Arad. That's
okay, my mistake.
I apologize for the bad English.
No, not at all. That's just the way I read it.
Yeah.
So now enter Congresswoman Jane Harman, a Democrat from Southern California in a district that includes heavy military industrial complex industries, a fairly hardline conservative Democrat, who was the ranking member when the Democrats were in the minority of the House Intelligence Committee. And she has been a staunch supporter of many what I consider to be incursions on our constitutional rights during the Bush era, including the domestic wiretapping program, the Military Commissions Act, and she voted for the invasion of Iraq. So she lines up pretty well with many hardline Republicans during that era. And she was very ambitious, hoping that when the Democrats were planning, and in fact did take control of the House after the 2006 midterm elections, she was angling to chair the Intelligence Committee. And Nancy Pelosi held the decision. She was minority leader and also a member of the Intelligence Committee at that time. And, of course, she rose to the position of Speaker and ultimately passed over Jane Harman as the chair of the Intelligence Committee in favor of Texan Sylvester Reyes. So a wiretap report has surfaced, and this is riddled with irony because Jane Harman was very gung-ho about the NSA's domestic surveillance program, even though she's kind of tried to backpedal publicly in some confusing public remarks that she's made over the last 6 months or so. Tell us what we know about this intercepted conversation between an unnamed Israeli citizen and Congresswoman Jane Harman.
Well, Jane was apparently intercepted in a telephone conversation where she was talking with an Israeli citizen who apparently was connected to Israeli intelligence in Washington. And this Israeli citizen basically told her that in return for her interference in the trial of Rosen and Weissman, obviously interfering in a favorable way for Rosen and Weissman, the Israeli interests would use their capability to obtain for her the job as head of the Intelligence Committee. And she basically, in the conversation, as far as we know, was receptive to this and said she would do what she could do. So basically, we had someone who might potentially have been chairing the House Intelligence Committee that basically would have owed that job to the Israeli lobby and to Israeli interests.
And is it true that from the reports you've gotten, none of us has seen this transcript, but the indications are that this Israeli citizen promised her that he would use his influence with the speaker-to-be Pelosi to lobby on behalf of Jane Harman?
That's correct. And apparently there is an indication that whoever this individual was, he actually did that. He lobbied with Pelosi. But the problem was Pelosi, because of her own role and her own connections, was aware that this is what was going on, and she felt it was much too dangerous to allow Harman to obtain the position.
Now, it's interesting because Jeff Stein exposed this case and did a very good job with this story for CQ, actually the CQ's blog page.
Right.
And then, of course, the mainstream media, as we just mentioned, they tried to bury it, and they did. The most interesting thing was the attitude of the so-called alternative media and the attack on the story on Jeff Stein and convoluting the story to make Jane Harman the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she was the victim of the illegal wiretap by NSA, which the case had nothing to do with it. In fact, she was not the target. So what explains the alternative media's aim in this? You know, with some of those people, I can attribute it to some ignorance, you know, or stupidity. But with some other reporters that I know about, in fact, some of them I do know, it seems to be more cynical.
Yeah, this is really an interesting story because the fact is that, you know, as you correctly point out, she was not the target of the investigation. The NSA was legally pursuing this case because it was a case of foreign espionage inside the United States involving the Israelis. So she was caught up in it. And the mainstream media and the alternative media basically focused on, oh, was this an NSA attack on our civil liberties? That was the way the story was spun. But, you know, the real way to spin this story is the fact that I was an intelligence officer. I know how it works. And what you do is you approach people and you get them on the hook. You get them to do something which they know is illegal, and then you have that person forever. And what the Israelis were doing in this case, clearly to me, was they were going to get Jane Harman, if she wasn't already a co-opted agent of the Israeli intelligence service, they were going to make sure that that's what she was. And she was going to be heading the intelligence committee. So, you know, you take that where you want to take it. But the fact is that this is a pretty frightening development, and it really was not played out in the media the way it should have been played out. And Jane Harman is still there. She wrote a piece last week attacking the CIA yet again in the San Francisco Chronicle, I believe. And, you know, this is typical of this woman. No conscience whatsoever and no accountability.
True.
And I'll just note for our listeners that a great progressive named Marcy Winograd has already filed papers to challenge Jane Harman next year in the Democratic primary in June here in California.
Well, God bless her, and I hope everyone votes for her.
Phil, just to clarify here, one more aspect of this. What we've just talked about is that a very powerful congresswoman with access to top-secret U.S. Briefings, and a woman who presumably was briefed on all the black operations that were initiated under the Bush-Cheney administration, in order to get the promotion she wanted, she was doing favors, and illegal favors, potentially,
yeah,
for this Israeli lobby group. You also have reported that Larry Franklin was spying for Israel because he wanted to leave the Pentagon and get a better job at the National Security Council, which, of course, is the White House-based group that advises the president on our most sensitive foreign policy issues. Now, this suggests that the route to promotion in Washington is not based on merit, it's not based on seniority, it's not based on party politics, it's based on loyalty to AIPAC and, in turn, to the nation of Israel.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that strongly, but what I would say is that clearly some of these people, Harmon and Franklin, saw that doing favors for Israel could be career-enhancing. Now, that doesn't mean you had to do favors for Israel to have your career improved, but the fact is some people clearly saw that that was a way to go. And that is a very frightening concept. It means basically that there is a foreign country that credibly believed that its word or its influence would determine who would get senior positions in the U.S. government, and that the people involved in this process, the Americans, believe that to be true.
In an earlier podcast with James Bamford, who has written several books about the National Security Agency, he disclosed that Israeli-made devices from companies named Verint and Naris were central to the domestic eavesdropping program, and that both of these companies are the personnel who run them have direct links to Unit 8200, which is the Israeli counterpart to our National Security Agency. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I know Jim well, and I know what he's been writing and saying, and yeah, sure. I mean, the fact is that I've written on the same subject for the American Conservative, and the fact is that when you control the technology that does the tell taps and that records the information, you have the key to the door. You can do anything you want with it. And these companies that are involved are Israeli owned. They have subsidiaries in the United States that they operate out of. And as I'm sure Jim mentioned to you, they control the technology. Some of the maintenance contracts for all of this equipment, basically, is done by Israelis. And essentially, the FBI and others have pointed out a number of times that this is a very dangerous situation.
You're listening to The Boiling Frogs. I'm Peter B. Collins with Sibel Edmonds, and we're talking with Philip Giraldi. Phil, next I'd like to ask what you know about former Republican Speaker Dennis Hastert. He was a congressman from Illinois, and after Newt Gingrich resigned and then his replacement, Livingston, had a short-lived speakership because of a sex scandal of his own in the South, then Hastert was this compromise candidate. He ended up as a speaker for a pretty long time, I think 7 or 8 years. And something surfaced in his last reelection campaign, which is that he received large amounts of money, but in very small individual contributions that fell below the federal threshold requiring full disclosure on who the donors were. And some investigations have shown that those small contributions that added up to a fairly significant amount of money were linked to Turkish interests. What more can you tell us about Dennis Hastert and his relationships with both the American Turkish Council, the Turkish government, and with AIPAC and Israel?
Well, I would certainly defer to Sibel on this issue because she's really the expert on it. But the fact is that it seems clear that Hastert was receiving large sums of money in small bits, as you correctly describe it, from groups that were linked to the Turks. Hastert is now working for a lobbying firm in Washington where he represents Turkish interests. So basically this is the revolving door in Washington where you engage in practices that are pretty shady while you're a congressman, and then you get out of Congress and you sign up with a lobbying group and you work for the same interests, but it's all up front now and you make a lot more money. I mean, this is one of the curses of Washington, and it's a curse that is essentially Democratic and Republican. There's nobody free from this. In fact, in the lobbying firm that Hastert works for, there, I believe there are a number of prominent ex-Democrats. So it's corruption is the name of the game in Washington, I'm afraid.
The parallel is amazing between Hastert and Harmon. And this is how I see the parallel, because Harmon kept saying, bring out the document and show that I was a target and that you had wiretap on me, when she knew 100% that was not the case. And that was the card she played, the bluff she made. And, of course, the mainstream media, even though they knew about it, they just let her get away with it. Same thing with Hastert. You know, the fact was that he was not the target. He didn't have to be the target. You know, usually the target, as it was with AIPAC, starts with the under FISA counterintelligence with the diplomatic community, okay? And that's the foreign entities here in the United States with the diplomatic jobs, whether it's the embassies or consulates. And during these counterintelligence operations, if and or when the FBI gathers information that the U.S. people are involved in activities against the United States interest or espionage, at that point they have an option. They have a case that they go and ask for a different kind of warrant from the court to go after the U.S. persons. And correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, because that was the case with these U.S. persons involved with Turkish counterintelligence-related operations, that they were not targets initially. The targets were the diplomatic or the foreign entities. And then, of course, with the Justice Department, the decision to pursue the U.S. persons criminally by going to the court and getting the warrant to have direct wiretap on these people or surveillance, that becomes a political issue. Now, if you have the case, the topic, or the subject, Iran, it's a different story. It will be very quick. Or North Korea, it would be very quick. But let's say if it's Israel, or if it's Turkey, or if it's Pakistan, or if it's Saudi Arabia, this is when, you know, the State Department, the Justice Department, the White House, they are looking at the political aspects of it, and they're saying, no, we don't want to do this. So then you get a lot of U.S. politicians, representatives, elected officials, and executive branch officials, U.S. officials, get away with all these activities against the United States interest, and some of them espionage.
Right. No, yeah, Sybil, I think that's exactly how the process works. And, but what I would emphasize is that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of corruption in Washington in terms of how this process works. That basically, you know, what comes out at the end of the day is not necessarily a result that's very good for the United States.
You're right. And you mentioned something else, and you mentioned this process of hooking, and that's exactly what they do. Now, the hooking can be via getting first some innocent information and then making that information level go higher and higher, money. And in some cases, it's just the sexual stuff. In one case that I had that I can't talk about the specifics, it was this particular congresswoman, and she's still a congresswoman, that these ATC and AIPAC-related individuals got dirt on her, okay? They found out that even though she was married, and she still is, and has grown-up kids, she is also, she's bisexual. She also has interest in other women. And they used that. They actually provided a Turkish lady to go and have an affair with her, and they recorded and they tape recorded the entire relationship, okay? Because in their initial attempt to hook this particular congresswoman for a particular objective they had did not work. So they went to the next level and said, okay, this is how we hook. So there are various ways that they go and they hook people.
Any comment, Phil Giraldi?
Well, no, that's an interesting story.
It is.
I'm not surprised at all at it, although I would think that it's obviously this is classic espionage and how you manage influence operations to control politicians in other countries, and so it's just somewhat surprising even to me to to hear that that sort of thing is going on in the United States.
Well, Phil, then, without spinning beyond what we know and what we can, you know, honestly project, how far does this go? Because many of us are quite stunned at the way the Obama administration has held on to and in some cases extended bad legal precedents that were established during the last 8 years, particularly related to state secrets, the failure to investigate obvious crimes or at least obvious elements of criminal behavior that are quite visible to the average citizen. And we have the work of Jim Bamford, which shows that virtually every telecommunication device is subject to intercept. They may not be able to monitor all of the traffic, but just about every email, just about every phone call, whether it's domestic or not, is subject to intercept by the NSA. So with the example of Jane Harmon and with the anecdote that Sibel just shared about an unnamed member of Congress, can we then project that to some extent our entire political population is somehow compromised by these various interests and their willingness to play hardball, to use blackmail to achieve their goals?
Well, I think you have to almost make that assumption. I'm not saying there aren't honest people in Congress, and I would cite certainly like Ron Paul.
Absolutely.
Yeah, among others that are honest and want to return to constitutionalism and to legal norms. But there are a lot of other, people get into politics and they get compromised all along the way. I think that's basically what you have to realize is the reality. But, what I'm concerned about, and you raise this issue, is the whole issue of what Obama is not doing. Why isn't Obama looking at some of these issues about that are basically constitutional rights type issues? And, you know, I keep hearing this in Washington, you hear all the time, I'm sure Sibel has too, that essentially, well, we know more than you do about security issues and terrorism and everything like that. I don't buy that. I mean, if there's a case to be made about why we haven't closed Guantanamo immediately, why we haven't gotten rid of the military commissions, why we haven't abolished the Patriot Act 1 and 2, I want to know what the reasons are why we're not doing that. Why is the no-fly, you said, what, 1.something million people names on the list? Why does this exist at all? And yet we've had no terrorist attacks since 9/11. So there's something very wrong here. There is something about the political process that's not working.
Are we moving towards a police state, or are we there?
Well, I think we have the infrastructure for the police state. It's there. They're capable of not only listening in on all the phone calls, but also monitoring, internet traffic and all that sort of thing. I don't know what the situation is, Sibel, where you live exactly. You're in Virginia too, aren't you?
Yes.
But the police forces get bigger and bigger and bigger here and more pervasive. I'm sure that's happening all over the United States. There's kind of a tolerance for police doing things, and because it's, they always say it's for our security and for our safety, but quite honestly, I find that a load of BS.
Right.
I think that crime rates, in fact, are going down. The fact is that I don't see more police as being a deterrent necessarily for terrorism. I don't think we have a serious terrorism threat inside the United States, and I think that all this stuff is being hyped because there are a lot of people who make money off of this. And I hate to say it, that maybe this is the problem with American capitalism, that money, it comes down to money. And there are there's a huge security industry in the United States, and not to mention what the Department of Defense costs us. And we're all doing this to fight six guys in a cave somewhere in Pakistan. It boggles the mind. And if I were someone that Obama would ever listen to, which I'm not, I would say to them, let's go back to zero and let's say, what is this all about? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? Why are we, you know, deliberately gutting the Constitution of the United States? Why are we doing all these things? And I'd like to find some, you know, some serious answers for this, and I haven't seen any.
And Phil, I'm old enough, and I'm suspecting you are too, to recall the Nixon era when the FISA law was created to deal with two very serious concerns. One was the domestic spying and counter-revolutionary actions of the FBI under the COINTEL program. It went far beyond law enforcement to infiltration and manipulation of certain groups that J. Edgar Hoover was very concerned about. And then there was, of course, the Watergate case, where Nixon attempted to play the FBI off against the CIA so that the investigation would go away. And so if we just look at that as the precursor of where we are today, then we really haven't fixed the problems. They've actually festered and expanded in ways that are beyond the knowledge of most Americans.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, the problems are far worse now. In terms of the intrusion, in terms of the privacy of every American citizen, the problem has become far, far worse. The NSA and the FBI and the local police, they have far more capabilities to look into your private life. quite recently, I've written a couple of pieces on the prevalence of traffic cameras in mm-hmm. the United States. And I don't know how you feel about that, but the traffic cameras, I mean, this is basically collecting information on private citizens who are doing nothing wrong. And this information goes into a database. And where does that information go? Does anyone know? Basically the technical capabilities to find out what American citizens are doing today is 1,000 times more than it was under Richard Nixon.
Well, in California, in addition to the insidious nature of these cameras that you describe, we have these red light cameras, and if you are captured in one of these frames where you appear to be going through an intersection and the light is red, you've already been convicted. There is no presumption of innocence. It's not innocent till proven guilty. And if you try to challenge it, since there was no human being there to see if, oh gosh, you had to stop because a dog got in your way or a pedestrian or any other extenuating circumstance, it's just flat thrown out. And in addition, the red light camera tickets are double fines, triple fines. It can cost you about $400 or $500, and a huge portion of that goes directly to the state treasury, not to the local municipality where you were caught and convicted on the spot. So it is insidious, both just on the civil liberties and criminal justice level, and on the question you raised, that there are more and more video cameras everywhere you go, and you have no idea who's watching and to what extent those tapes are being preserved for some unknown future use.
That's exactly right, and that's the issue. Because basically, all right, people will argue one way or another about the safety aspect. Now, first of all, when anybody says safety, that's when you start to cringe, because they're selling you a bill of goods that they know is not sellable in any other way. So I always have very, you know, worried when anybody says it's for my safety. But anyway, what you're saying is absolutely correct, and these cameras operate basically the same way here on the East Coast. And I believe I'm correct in saying that the Washington area has one-third of all these types of cameras that are in the United States overall. So this is a major issue. That this is a privacy issue. This is a security issue in terms of your personal security, in terms of where this information winds up and what they do with it. And I think that basically Americans have to come to grips with this. They have to stop saying, yes, I trust the government and the government will do what is right, because the government is a corrupt organization that is not going to do what is right.
Phil, I know whistleblowers in intelligence agencies are kind of rare. So they're a rare breed. But why haven't we had more, or actually any, whistleblowers from the CIA, actually in large numbers, come forward on these cases of rendition and torture, and in some cases murder, that were carried out during the Bush administration, and it seems like it's going to be carried out during this administration. Why haven't we had these whistleblowers, these people, good people in CIA who would, you know, who get disgusted and say, you know what, this is not what I signed up for, and I'm not going to do this?
Well, Sybil, you know, the simple answer to that is follow the money. Currently, most recent retired CIA officers and FBI officers, I believe is probably also true, are picked up as contractors and make a lot of money after they retire. So these people are, again, working for the government, and they are not allowed to say anything, and they're protective of the fact that they're making a lot of money. So, you know, all of the people that are my contemporaries that I know of, virtually every one of them is still working for the government as a government contractor. So essentially, you know, the people who might have had a conscience and might have said something are basically looking at the bottom line on this. As you certainly know, there are a number of former CIA people who have spoken out, but you're quite right. They're not as many as you would expect, and I think the reason is follow the money.
And Phil, going back to your service, did you find that this type of corruption, of money over ethics, was prevalent at the agency when you worked there?
Well, you know, that's a tough question to answer. Certainly, there were a lot of people in the agency that were very career oriented, and they were, you know, they cut corners to get promoted, to get ahead, to do this, and there always was a bottom line in terms of money, in terms of what you would be doing after you left government work. So there is a corruption aspect in terms of how the government service was perceived for a lot of people. But most people basically were ethically well balanced. But the problem is in our society that the lure of money and everything corrupts everything.
And in your view, did the Church Commission accomplish the reforms that we were publicly led to believe were implemented? Was there a sea change following that in the early 1980s?
That's when I basically came into the agency. I came in 1976. And the fact is that the Church Commission basically shut the door on certain activities like assassinations. But essentially, if you look at the legislation that was passed after the Church Commission, the Director of Central Intelligence had considerable latitude, and also the White House, in terms of authorizing other operations. So to a certain extent, it really didn't do anything but close the door on the more extreme operations.
And Phil, is this a cul-de-sac? Is there an exit from what we see as a creeping police state, what we see as the elements of fascism arising before us?
You know, I don't have a good answer to that. I think that basically the American people have been led down a road where essentially they're so concerned about what they see as their security, they've been conned into this, that they're basically willing to give up many of their civil liberties to feel more safe. And I think this is a bad deal. I don't think there's a major threat against the United States, either from terrorists or indeed from anybody else. And we have a huge military-industrial complex. We have a huge security complex inside the United States. We have police everywhere. You know, all these people have a vested interest in keeping this thing going the way it is. And I think that I had hoped better from Obama. I really felt that Obama might change the tone of this debate and change the narrative that was going on, but I haven't seen that.
I guess you're more optimistic, or I am way too cynical, because I did not expect much from Obama, because I looked at his record and I kept looking at his record. In fact, in Congress, there's only one man I trust, and that is Ron Paul, and that is based on his record. And if you were to go and look at this man's record, whether it's in war or on our civil liberties, the record speaks for itself. Now, on the other hand, I know the long-term objectives they have in place, and this is the Ron Paul movement, with these activists, these solid, really, really nice people who are trying to put in Congress some real representatives, the people with backbone, people who care. But again, it seems to be so long-term, you know. During the Depression, you know, John Maynard Keynes, when they asked him about the long-term plans or the effects of his economic plans, he said, well, in long-term, we will be all dead. So right now, we can't really talk about the long-term. And to me, it seems like with this really rapid growth of the security police state, and as you said, the military-industrial complex, another thing I've been noticing here in Virginia, there are all these different companies that work as contractors with the government, with the federal government, and even some small travel agencies that, let's say, has a contract work with the Department of Education, now their employees, these travel agents, have to get top secret clearance or secret clearance because they consider, the federal government considers arranging tickets for, this is Department of the Education's employee, would require people who have security clearance. You see a lot of these young guys in, you know, at the bars, and they think it's a cool, hot thing, you know. Yeah, I worked for this whatever computer company, or I'm working for this travel agency, and I've got SCI, I have security clearance. But they have no idea what the implications of having security clearance is. And almost everyone I know, and I'm not talking about people who work within the government, they either are seeking to obtain one because they think that's going to bring them higher pay, they can obtain jobs much easier, and I'm not talking about with government. It's various sectors. So these long-term plans, to me, they don't represent that much hope because I see these rights eroding in this very, very high speed. And what can be done to counter that?
I wish I had an answer to that one. You know, I see the same thing happening. I see that we've become sort of a security state. I'm not so sure if it were that much different than the 5th century of the Roman, you know, the last century of the Roman Empire. It's an awful situation. It's you know, we started out as a country where people were self-reliant and people valued their liberties, and now we've become a country that basically preys on fear, and fear is what drives what everyone does. It's I, you know, all I can say is we have to keep speaking out on the issue, people like yourself and myself, and we have to make sure that people are aware that there is an alternative narrative about all this, that basically we've gone crazy, we've gone overboard, and we're doing things that we shouldn't have to be doing and that are basically destroying the U.S. Constitution. And you know, I agree with you about Ron Paul. I mean, Ron Paul is the certainly the preeminent congressman. There are others. So, you know, he's not the only one, but he's certainly the preeminent congressman in terms of understanding just how these issues have been destroying us as a nation.
And, Phil, one of the things that I see here that is very discouraging is that it's hard to imagine a scenario where we start to ratchet down because fear has been inculcated and the blurring of entertainment and reality on television where people see 24 as presenting reasonable scenarios that, yeah, you know, if you torture somebody, they'll tell you, you know, what the next terrorist operation is going to be. And so I find it hard to imagine a scenario where we will relax security at our airports, where Sibel will be able to carry enough baby formula on an airplane to actually feed her child to the destination. And it just strikes me that this is a somewhat of a cul-de-sac. It's a dead end where the only way is to add to the security apparatus. We will never be permitted to rationally restructure it or reduce it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that's the danger, and certainly the indications of where this is going that are coming out of the Obama administration are no better than the Bush administration.
Right.
And that's the scary thing about all this. Look at the, you know, there have been three arrests for terrorism cases three separate cases in the past week and a half. And I challenge you to, you know, go to the, say, the New York Times or something and read the accounts of what these people were arrested for and what was all involved with it. And at the end of it, ask yourself, did all of this make sense? Are these real terrorists? What is really going on here? What are the stories, and what is the story that is being spun here to make it look like there's a terrorist threat, maybe where there isn't one?
And Phil, I would only add to that that often the initial reporting does not disclose the role of a paid informant.
Right.
Domestically, it's usually the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
But we have the Lodi Mosque case here in California. There were the schlubs in Florida who were led by an FBI informant to buy uniforms, to pledge some cockamamie oath to Osama bin Laden. And then not just once, but twice, the prosecutors attempted to convict these people despite the shaky nature of the case and the obvious role of a paid informant. And this goes back to COINTELPRO, where we have law enforcement agencies that are putting provocateurs into the mix in order to produce events that then can result in crackdowns and convictions. And that cycle feeds the media. It feeds the paranoia of the people who get their news in 20-second sound bites from television.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. And that's the scary thing. And I would add a number of other cases, the Haitians in Miami, the people in Philadelphia that were allegedly going to bomb Fort Dix with their pizza boxes, the paint gunners in Virginia. You know, every one of these cases, or nearly every one of these cases, has an FBI agent who's an agent provocateur, as you correctly put it, who's inserted in the case and is encouraging these people to do things. So, you know, we become, you know, is this any different than Stalin? Is this any different than Adolf Hitler? I mean, come on. The fact is that, you know, we have always prided ourselves on being a country where we've had a rule of law, and we've had restrictions on what the government can do. And it seems that in the last 8 years in particular, we've decided, no, we don't really need that anymore. We need to feel safe. And I would argue, no, you're no safer now. You're in fact much less safe, because the government, everybody that basically approves of all these activities say, okay, what we're doing is we're arresting Muslims, and it's kind of okay. But, you know, it's Muslims today, and it's somebody else tomorrow.
Phil Giraldi, thank you for joining us today. Philip Giraldi served at the Central Intelligence Agency. He is a contributing editor to the American Conservative. He's a fellow at the American Conservative Defense Alliance, and he publishes at antiwar.com. Any other sites where we can find your commentaries?
I also publish for Ron Paul's site, Campaign for Liberty.
All right. Phil, thank you very much. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Sybil.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews. Until then.